Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
Well, I'm getting my silver tone. You get to play it if and only if you sing.
Right, yeah, okay. I can tell this is one of those things where I keep saying no and you think I'm just asking you to beg more.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, well, look, I'm not a trained poodle.
I thought singing was a joyous expression of the soul.
Yeah. All right. This one's early. Joe should like it.
If I had wings and nor a dove, I'd fly up the river. One I love, very well, oh honey.
What are you doing?
What?
What is that? What are you doing?
Well, it's Mike's part.
Don't do that.
It's Mike's part.
I know what it is. Don't do that.
Hello and welcome to Podshots. I'm your host, Eric Williams, and on today's episode, we are taking a look at the 2013 film Inside Llewyn Davis. The film stars Oscar Isaac and Carey Mulligan and was written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen. And here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Ben Teed.
Yeah! Hello!
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. And Ben, let's do a little midweek drink roll call. What do you have for
yes.
me there?
Okay, so today I have from Two E's Winery. It's a local winery, here in northern Indiana that is, it's not in Fort Wayne, it's just outside of Fort Wayne in a town called Huntington. It's a Two E's Winery. My job takes me all over the place. I'm shooting, you know, all sorts of different segments for the show I put on at my new station.
Mm-hmm.
And today we went to Two E's Winery and I met the Two E's, Eric and Aaron. Shout out to them. And
nice.
they make their own wine, and they're like not much older than I am. They're kind of, I'm a little jealous of their success. What am I doing with my life? Exactly. So one day they just went, hey, let's just make a wine, you know, grow some grapes and make some wine.
I'm like, just wait till you're about 8 years older.
I know, it's gonna kill me. So I'm drinking their Tenet Red Table Wine. It's a drier one, and it is. I didn't know this until I got it home. This explains why it was a little bit more expensive than the other ones. It is 15.7% alcohol content by volume.
Mama.
So this is going to be a great night / weekend because I won't be waking up till Sunday, it looks like.
Ben's going to be making, you're going to make all of the sense towards the end of the recording.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
You know what it's saying, man?
I've already taken a drink of it and I looked down at the bottle and then saw it and then went, oh, shoot. All right. Well, here we go.
That's really funny. I like that you have an elaborate story there behind your drink. I
needed something.
Yeah. I wish I had something as fancy as that. I'm having a Red Bull and vodka.
Oh, hell yeah. That's a Thursday night.
I'm drinking candy is what it's like.
Oh, man.
I will say that it is the sugar-free because sugar is not allowed in this house.
So, not anymore.
Yeah, can't have it. Can't have it. Okay, so that's what we're having to drink. Before we get into our discussion, I should mention that Audible is still offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast. And choose from over 180,000 audio programs. Download one of those for free and start listening. It's just that simple. So go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and get started today. All right, Ben. With that, let's kick off our discussion of yet another intimidating...
It was going to come up at some point.
It's like our series of overwhelming filmmakers. That's what the podcast should have been called. We'll do our own. It's called Overwhelming Filmmakers.
I don't know what you're talking about. We're both experts here.
It's where we feel.
Yeah, this is our field. This is our. Yeah, we're experts.
We feel inadequate for every conversation. It'll be fine. Anyway, it came out in 2013, and it is Inside Llewyn Davis.
How you doing, Llewyn Davis?
Oh, hello. I've heard your music. And heard many nice things about you from Jim and Gene and from others.
You have not heard one nice thing about me from Gene.
Oh, it's fairly well, my darling true. I'm leaving in the first hour of the morning.
No, you don't want to go anywhere. And that's why all the same shit is going to keep happening to you, because you want it to.
Is that why?
Yes, and also because you're an asshole.
Maybe the coast of California. So it's fairly well.
What'd you say you played?
Folk songs.
Folk songs. I thought you said you were a musician.
Another day, another time. It ain't believing.
Folk singer with a cat.
It's not my cat. I just didn't know what to do with it.
Really? So, did you bring your dick along too?
I should have had you wear double condoms. Well, we shouldn't have done it in the first place, but if you ever do it again, which is a favor to women everywhere, you should not. But if you do, you should be wearing condom on condom and then wrap it in electrical tape.
Though the weather is against me, and the wind blows hard, the rain, she's a-turning in
the... I'm interested in gigging here.
Okay, let's hear something.
You don't want to hear the record?
Why should I? You're here. Play me something. Play me something from Inside Llewyn Davis.
Okay.
Anyway, the IMDb plot synopsis goes like this. Follow a week in the life of a young folk singer as he navigates the Greenwich Village folk scene of 1961. Guitar in tow, huddled against the unforgiving New York winter, he is struggling to make it as a musician against seemingly insurmountable obstacles, some of his own making. Okay, so Ben, we decided upon this film, and like we joked earlier, we tend to do either Kubrick or Cohen. That Kubrick and Cohen. That is another podcast title for people out there. I got them all today. That tends to be what we choose to talk about. What brought you to this film? Did you just say, "Oh, it's the newest Coen brothers, so I should probably go see it"? Or what was the impetus behind
it? At least back when it came out, I definitely knew. This might be one of the first Coen Brothers films that I saw in theaters.
Oh, there.
Because I was just starting to catch on to them. Not just starting. I'd been on them for a little while. But no, that's not true. I saw Burn After Reading. Mm. Anyways.
Your first good one then?
Oh, jeez. I do need to revisit that one.
That would be interesting because I watched it and was just like, I don't know.
I remember liking it back then, but that I haven't seen it since.
Yeah.
So
anyway.
Yeah. So we saw this. Me and my wife went mostly just because I had bought the soundtrack before the movie came out.
Okay.
And we loved the music. I'm not usually a folk person like very much, you know. But my wife definitely is. I mean, she plays guitar and she you know is very interested in that type of genre of music. And we both love, this is the first time that I remember even hearing about Oscar Isaac, even though I'd seen him in another film, Robin Hood. He plays a character in that film. But, this is the first time we're seeing him carrying a film.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there hoping for, this is amidst the excitement of Carey Mulligan being in a bunch of films.
Yes.
And I'm like, ooh, yes. You know, an Education. And what was the other one where she plays like a clone or a
oh oh my goodness
it's based off a book and I hate
Never
that
Let
I
Me Go
remember.
Never Let Me
yes,
Go
yes yes just loved her and all the stuff that I was seeing around 2013.
Yeah.
And then I think after this film, I didn't really see her in much, or at least I don't really get to see her. I didn't see Shame.
Oh, so, our mutual friend Zach Krusey and I did the movie Shame.
That's right.
And that is a tremendous film. She did this just after doing The Great Gatsby.
That's another one that I was like, oh, yes, I got to see that. Because just for the fact that she's in it, like, I'm a huge Carey Mulligan fan. So
yeah, she's only been in Suffragette and Far From the Maddening Crowd since.
Ah, okay, yes. I've heard Suffragette was one that I really wanted to pick up last year and didn't get a chance to.
I wonder why that is. I wonder if she's... she's married, so I don't know if she's maybe having some family time or what exactly the deal is. But yeah, she was in a lot of stuff for a while. Now she's kind of slowing down a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know. The other one was John Goodman, of course.
Oh yes,
gotta see him, and you know, especially when he's connected with the Coens.
right.
You know, he's usually playing some sort of surly type of personality. And the one that was interesting to me was Justin Timberlake. Like, what is he
yes.
doing in this movie?
Yes.
And I thought, this will be different. Because I think the year before or the year before that, I had seen him perform play the Napster guy from Social Network. And I really liked him in that role. I thought he was very well casted for the Social Network. So for David Fincher's film, and for him to jump over to a Coen Brothers film, I was interested the moment they say Joel and Ethan Coen.
Oh, sure.
Written and directed, but.
Right.
But yeah. And this one seemed like one that, having left the theater, I remember feeling kind of like, well, that wasn't No Country for Old Men. That wasn't.
Yes.
Actually, I saw that one too in theater, so maybe this wasn't my. Yeah. I kept thinking, like, yeah, I was into
the lie just keeps getting unraveled.
Yeah, it just keeps, yeah. I'm just remembering all these films that they've been doing. But yeah, it was one of those where it didn't. Could you say that there's even a plot to this film? Because it's one of those things that you kind of just follow Llewyn Davis through these scenes and through these different shades of his life and different perspectives and stuff like that. It almost changes. It never really leaves him at all, but you really kind of I remember thinking at the end of it, I'm like, oh wow, like that was much different than what I was expecting.
Yeah, really.
But I remember really enjoying just coming out of it and loving it.
Mm-hmm.
But not for the same reason I loved all the other Coen films I've seen.
Yeah. This was a first time watch for me. I'm always interested in Coen Brothers films, and I say that, but then again, I didn't see this until for the recording, you know, so how interested am I really is kind of the question, but I always think of like, oh, it's a Coen Brothers movie. I should see that, you know, as of the release of this, we will have already talked about their remake of True Grit, which we haven't actually recorded yet, but that's the magic of podcasting. But we'll be talking about that soon. And, you know, I mean, my first movie of them was The Big Lebowski that I was sort of aware of. Like, once I grew up and realized that they did Raising Arizona, I was like, oh, yeah, well, I know who those guys are. I've known them for a while. But anyway, I didn't know of Oscar Isaac when the movie had come out either. Obviously, since then, I absolutely loved him in Ex Machina. I thought that that was such a completely different guy from what is in this. You know, and he just had that sort of smart yet I could kick your ass if I want to sort of look about him. And here he's playing a much different role. And then obviously in Star Wars, so he was a guy that I was excited after knowing him now to revisit. And, of course, Carey Mulligan is a draw for me. And, some of the other people like John Goodman, like you already mentioned. Interestingly enough, my soon-to-be, as of recording, my soon-to-be father-in-law, it looks a lot like John Goodman.
Oh, really?
Yeah, not in a great way. Like in 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Oh, wow.
That movie, he looks like him like in that. Like just kind of the scruffy, like built kind of like, because the guy in real life used to bodybuild. And is just kind of like a bigger guy now. And so But he's kind of got that sort of John Goodman kind of heft about him. But anyway, So now whenever I see him, I'm like, Randall? Oh, no, it's John Goodman. So that's kind of my very brief history with the film. I will say that I really did enjoy the movie, and I say that carefully in that I enjoyed it. I didn't love it. The movies that I tend to love from the Coens are, I think that they handle large scope films really, really well, like No Country for Old Men. That's the only movie where I watched the DVD, sight unseen and finished it and then started it again and watched it again. Just watched it twice straight through. Because I just like couldn't believe sort of what I was seeing in such a good way. And while I wasn't expecting the same sort of thing out of this film, because I kind of intentionally didn't know much about it. I just knew it was a folk singer in New York. And so I kind of, you know, you can gather that the scope isn't going to be real large. But it's just such a quiet and intimate film that I think you're right, doesn't have much of a plot really, and is definitely okay with that because it doesn't really try to force a plot on there that much. And, you know, I really think that it's like a real nice kind of a date sort of a movie because it's not,
yeah,
it's not going to do anything.
It was a good date.
It's not going to be, there's nothing really offensive in it. I mean, they have some hard subject matter where they talk about Carey Mulligan's character having an abortion or maybe going to have an abortion. They talk about that, but they just kind of talk about it. Like they don't really, there's nothing too upsetting besides just bringing up the subject. But I really did like the way that it was framed. And, I guess that's my first question for you is, I don't know, maybe I was looking down and writing or I didn't realize that I didn't realize until we get to the end of the movie that the beginning was ahead of the rest of the movie. Does that make sense?
The beginning, yes.
So the beginning performance, I didn't realize till we get to the very end that was like...
Right, and what a way to open that film, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because you realize what like a miserable schmuck Llewyn Davis is. Just, I mean, not in anything but by his performance. He's definitely a different type of performer. People don't normally play the guitar the way... that guy can, and specifically Oscar Isaac, Juilliard guy, can play in the way he does, but I'm talking about in the choice of song. He starts off with Hang Me, Oh Hang Me, you know, and like starts talking about, you know, this more depressing type of subject matter in his songs, whereas everyone else around him, any other performers that go on after him, they're all very, classic and maybe more Americana, maybe more heartwarming.
Yeah,
And a nice
old timey with Troy Nelson's character, like a real old country western kind of a guy.
And it's almost like they kind of bookend the movie with this same scene of him getting punched out in the alley.
Right.
And the thing that you don't see the first time, and they end the movie with this, is right as he's going out to, quote, meet his friend out in the alley, is a young Bob Dylan getting up on stage. And it makes me think someone like Llewyn Davis, who is this, like, he's just kind of miserable and depressed.
Yeah, he's definitely struggling, yeah.
But I feel like a singer like him and a person that plays that type of darker music, was just before his, like, he's just a day early. mm-hmm. before all that stuff takes off with before that style becomes popular with, because this is 1961.
Yeah.
That the film takes place in, and it's at the Gaslight, and he is performing his song, and then like immediately after, Bob Dylan comes on, or someone that looks like Bob Dylan.
Yeah, someone that's supposed like to. Yeah, someone that's supposed to be Bob Dylan.
And it's almost like the movie's telling me that Llewyn Davis is like a day early. Like if only he had lived a second longer to see the Dylan era and maybe have a fighting chance, either playing with him or you know, not to say that he dies in this movie or anything like that, but like. It's almost like you wish you could have seen him continue after this film, because it could have been maybe a success story for Llewyn Davis. Whereas this feels like he's sinking. He's not surviving very well.
Mm-hmm.
Even giving up and going off and doing other things. That's another interesting thing about this film, I think, is it's a look at the artist and how. You know, people try to get him to go down different roads, and he just says, no, this is what I want to tell. This is what I want to do. He always talks about, I play guitar. I do this for a living.
Oh, yes. When he's upset at Neelix from Voyagers.
Yeah,
he's
not
at
a,
his house.
I'm not a trained monkey. I'm a musician that gets, this is how I make my living. And no one else seems concerned with that. They're all worried about, you know, or Jim and who they play it. Jim and
Jill.
Jane. Jim and Jill.
Gene and Jim.
Gene and Jim. Yeah. Oh yes. And they're all talking about how they just want to, you know, buy a house and live in the suburbs and have kids and stuff like that. And he's like, oh, that's careerist and mm-hmm. quite boring and stuff mm-hmm. like that. He really is, like, right before the 60s really takes off and all that musical revolution of, cause the 60s is a time of this revolution in music and in film and all these different, voices come out, during that time, that aren't these classic sounding country western, you know, sound, you know, 50s cowboys.
Yes.
That kind of sound like that. This is someone who's very, and I'm very much into that. Like that's kind of why I wouldn't consider this my favorite, Coen Brothers film, but it's definitely one that I really like, because of, even though for not having a plot, there's just stuff that happens to him and his attitude in it. And Oscar Isaac is really, so depressed and stuff like that. Most people probably wouldn't be into that. Most people would probably want a happier film. I kind of like this.
Oh,
I
yeah.
Guess,
oh, yeah. That fits in exactly with my sensibilities.
Yeah.
And I think that you're right, because I think that the way that this film decides to end with Bob Dylan being there and Llewellyn is so concerned with, or Llewyn, I always call him Llewellyn. Llewyn Davis is so concerned with music that matters, music that actually means something. And you can tell by the way that he, like pulls his face when he's singing, you know, that it's like paining him to sing his lyrics, right?
Yeah.
And he's feeling everything that he's singing and it's getting him nowhere because the sort of popular culture isn't ready for that yet. Meanwhile, he can get onto a different track with Justin Timberlake and Adam Driver and, you know, throw away his royalties, which of course you know that that's going to hurt him in the long run. When he's like, no, just give me my money now. I don't need the royalties. And I'm like, well, that's dumb. Like, that's not going to turn out well for him. And that's the Please Mr. Kennedy song. And they're, you know, Adam Driver's doing silly sounds with his voice and it's really poppy and silly and just kind of the time. And it's much different in the way that Oscar Isaac's character is, choosing to sing and the things that he's talking about. You know, they're much different. And so it's a tragedy in Llewyn Davis's life that he's unable to, you know, either stick around that bar or like understand that Bob Dylan is also of like mind and that the two of them can work together or can get signed together or can try to accomplish the same goals. Because if he was able to, you know, join up with him in some capacity, then, you know, Llewyn Davis could have been in this fictional world a big deal like Bob Dylan.
Yes. And there's so many times too, besides the Bob Dylan thing and besides all the things he makes at the beginning of the film, he makes just some of these choices in it that you're just like you're so talented, you're so good, there's nothing you do better. Like not even your own real life.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of mess things up. You're kind of, you have a kid somewhere.
Oh, yes, that he didn't know about, yeah.
That you think of maybe for like an afternoon and then you don't go and deal with that, you know. It's just, I'm sure it's on his mind at some point, at some points in the film or something like that. But, when he goes to Chicago, he finally makes it there. He's got one shot to make it to this, to impress this,
Mr. Grossman, yeah.
Yeah, it was Grossman, Bud Grossman, played by F. Bernie Abraham. I really like him. I remember him from,
Amadeus.
Grand Budapest and Amadeus, yeah.
Yeah.
Of all the music he decides to play, he plays The Death of Queen Jane. And it's, of course, an amazing song and really beautiful, but it's not the commercialness that everything else. It's like, obviously it's not Please Mr. Kennedy. It's not, he even tells him, I wish you would be more human, or you should try to be a little bit more, have a little bit more human connection.
Oh yes, he doesn't connect. Yeah, he doesn't connect.
And I find that so fascinating, because it's just like, that's not what Llewyn Davis wants to do. And even though it will save his life, even though it will get him some food on the table, maybe give him a place to sleep or something like that. I think there's something to be said about the Coen brothers building a film about a guy who is unrelenting in his art.
Mm-hmm.
Also, to go along with that, and to go along with his depressedness or whatever, having kind of there's almost a sainthood to his partner Mike. He used to be Mike and
Mike and Llewyn.
Mike and Llewyn doing their thing. And then of course we find out through dialogue that Mike kills himself. And there's a bit of like, like Mike is sacred.
And it was also, they definitely deify him. It's like, oh, well, Mike was the one who kept this together. And the Mr. Grossman saying, well, he used to have a partner, and Mr. Grossman's like, well, that makes sense. You know, it's kind of like he couldn't carry it on his own, is what he kind of implies or basically says.
But the Coens themselves
they
are a partnership. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this is some sort of, I get this feeling like maybe it's their way of saying how important their creative partner is, or what it would be like if they didn't have each other, or, I mean, perhaps.
That's really interesting, because it's funny that they choose then, it's not like they were super successful together and then he's trying to do it on his own. Because when he's trying to get money, he's like, look, it's not like this was a big hit. It's not like there's a lot of audience adjustment here.
It's a very good point.
Yeah. So I just think that that's funny that they, you know, if that's what we want to read into it about the Coens and their own brotherhood and, them putting that on this film, it is interesting that they weren't at least a moderate success or something. So I do think that's interesting. What did you think about when you had mentioned the Mr. Grossman sequence, and he is, he does choose a very dark song. And he says that, and we have this sort of movie moment where we're at a medium shot and we sort of slow push in, right?
Yes.
We push in on Llewyn Davis, and I'm like, okay, here's where he gets his break. Like, he's singing this powerful song. He's playing it really well. This is the moment. This is where things are going to turn around for him. And I was genuinely surprised when he's like, this isn't going to be a place for you, or this isn't going to work for you, or whatever he says, whatever the exact quote is. But he basically tells him, I'm not interested. And I was like, what?
That doesn't sell anything.
Yeah.
It's not commercial enough. You're not making a human connection in your art. Where I would argue he probably is, it's just his way of expressing himself and his depression at this time for losing his partner, for being poor, for screwing things up with all these women, you know,
yeah,
and not having really any friends, and kind of having to be a little bit of a jerk, if not, he's already just a slime ball, you know?
Yeah. Well, here's where my weird, you had your brothers and the Mike and Lewin thing. Here's where I got off on one about the Coens and their meta commentary. So he is making this, he has this performance. They say, oh, it's not commercial enough. It's not going to work. Are we supposed to think that Mr. Grossman is just an asshole? Like, that, are we supposed to agree with him and say, yeah, he's not actually that good? Or are we supposed to be like, wait a minute, of course he's good. What's wrong with these people? And it made me think of this being in 2013 with movies. And the Coens are making these heartfelt and dark sometimes and personal films, while we have movies like The Avengers and the Batman,
which are all very sellable and very commercial,
which are all easily digestible, and you know what you're going to get, and everything's revealed before you get there, and it's just no work. And just like how some of the country music performer Troy Nelson, it's no work to sit there and listen to him because you know what you're getting. There's no surprise, there's no heart really for me behind that style of music, at least in that portrayal. And that's what I feel like about big blockbuster movies.
Still good. I think Troy is a great performer and sings his stuff, but there's so much more I get out of, and you get out of him singing Fairly Well with Mike, or him, getting into, the Shoals of Herring where he sings to his father or something like that. There's so much more in those, so much more feeling. And the same is true for any of the Coen films.
Sure. You know?
That's actually a very good
point. It's just like, you know, The Avengers, well made, you know, technically sound, left me saying, you know, like, all right, I saw a bunch of cool stuff and people blew each other up and that was fun. And now what? You know?
I gotta say, I don't want to sit there and be like, you know, throw my scarf over my shoulder and fix my beret. But like, I literally haven't seen a single superhero film this year. I just haven't.
Oh, well, we are the same, my friend.
Yeah, and it's not because I don't like him or I don't want to see him or anything like that. I have so much more different things I want to see. We're getting a little off topic here, but essentially, but I think it still ties in with what we're talking about. With a very commercial type of world that we're like these superhero films are the new Western. Mm-hmm. Like they are just constantly, they're the popular thing at the time and they keep coming out. And I can see why they're popular and I can see why people love them. It's the same reason why I grew up reading the comics that they were based off of.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's comes to a point though where there's so much put into them and they're so dense with visual effects and not a lot of, once again,
not human, a lot of heart, not a lot
yeah,
of
character. Heart in it and stuff like that. Something like Please Mr. Kennedy though is very fun and interesting to me, but I think it's fun, that scene in particular is fun because of, Justin Timberlake and Oscar Isaac's, banter right before he talks about, this is fine and all, but who wrote this? And he's like, I don't. And the look he gives him before that. All right, we're about to start. We're counting down. We're recording. And 3, 2, 1. And they start singing. And it's just so ridiculous.
Oh,
but it's very 1961. Like, this is right before Kennedy's killed. This is right before this is right as the space race is taken off and things are going nuts with sending people out into on Apollo missions and stuff like that. So they really are like, it's a of the now, piece of fluff.
Mm-hmm. And you get to see Kylo Ren making funny sense.
That is the first time I saw Adam Driver. And, when I heard the announcement that, he is going to play something in Star Wars, in the J.J. Abrams Star Wars, I immediately thought of him saying, outer space, outer space, because that is a great joke.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things where Coens or whoever they have casting for them finds these, and forgive me for people that are in this movie, but like, some of them are just plain not traditional Hollywood good looking people.
Oh, sure.
It's
yeah.
just they find the most regular everyday people to play, and the back and forth between the two, the couple that was his original recording label.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got no money and stuff like that. And they're going, you want me to bring you over Cincinnati?
Yeah, you have Cincinnati?
Yeah, bring it over. You want me to bring it? Huh? Yeah, bring it over. Like, just back and forth. Like, they are so good at that type of just, like, their characters. These are real, and they feel real, and it's so funny. And you can just see Llewyn Davis just slinking in his chair, getting madder and madder as time goes on.
Yeah, well, but he has that great bit where he threatens to take his coat unless he gives him some kind of an advance, and then he takes his coat, and then it just kind of goes back and forth where the old guy doesn't just go like, yeah, 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 take my coat, whatever. And it just goes back and forth.
Hilarious.
That's really made me laugh.
We get that kind of stuff all the time in Coen Brothers films.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's, I can't even begin to tell you how you write a scene like that, how you make a scene like that. Like, it's almost like it has to be done there in the room on the spot. How do you write that on? What does that look like on the page? You know, it's just, I can't even. There's a scene, and it reminds me of a scene at No Country for Old Men. Anton Chigurh goes into, I believe, maybe like an office or something like that. The only person that ever stood up to Anton Chigurh that we could see and lives to tell it so far, because they didn't show her death, was that woman, that Texan woman sitting at the desk going, I'm not gonna give you that information.
Oh, yes.
Like, she stands up to him, but her delivery and her line is so like, you don't know who you're messing with. This, first of all, you're so of the real world. You're plucked straight from a Texan office and you're dealing with this like bringer of death, this dark force. And it's so like, it's so beautiful and so perfect, but how do you make that? I don't know.
Yeah. So. What does that look like? That is a mystery, I would think. One of the things that I wanted to make sure and bring up is we had already mentioned John Goodman a little bit before, but I think I was surprised at how his character, I sort of thought he was going to be the main heavy in the second act or in the third act.
He kind of comes and then floats away.
Yeah. And Roland Turner is the character's name, and he's asleep most of the time when Lewin's on his way to Chicago and looking very funny, John Goodman being the size that he is when he's depicted sleeping in this. And one of the things that I thought was really funny is I loved how he just kept saying, this would interest you. And then he just says some jazz line, and then it's something, and then he goes, Lewin, this would interest you. And he just keeps saying this
would interest simpler.
You.
Oh, it's simpler. We actually use all the keys. All the chords.
12 chords, three.
he is this kind of weird force of nature that comes in and then just kind of rolls away, you know. Johnny Five as well, mm-hmm. The guy that's in the car with him that's doing a lot of the driving. There's just some really good lines with Roland, and then Johnny Five, and there's almost never any talk between Johnny and Roland, though.
Right.
I just found that so interesting because it's like you're either dealing with Roland and that's it, or you're dealing with Johnny Five and that's it. And the time that he asks, you know, can I bum a cigarette? And Johnny Five says, I'm all out.
Mm-hmm.
And then like the very next scene, he's puffing on a cigarette and Llewyn Davis is so mad at him. It's so good. But yeah.
One of the things, I guess, before we got too far is I thought this was, I think it kind of goes without saying now, but I thought that this was a tremendous performance by Oscar Isaac. And I don't know that I went ahead and said that specifically, I guess. But I thought it was, I thought it was tremendous. He did get nominated for a Golden Globe for best performance in a comedy or musical, and then a best original song for Please Mr. Kennedy was in there. And then it did get nominated also for a Golden Globe for best musical or comedy motion picture. And it did get nominated for an Academy Award for cinematography and sound mixing. But go ahead.
I was going to say, it is kind of a black comedy. I was going to say,
oh, it is. Yeah. And that's what I was going to say is, are you perchance a viewer of New Girl?
No, I have not. I'm thinking of Girls. Because with Adam Driver.
Yeah.
I've seen a few episodes of New Girl.
Okay, New Girl.
And like it. I like it a lot.
With Jack Johnson. Or Jake Johnson.
Jake Johnson.
Yeah. Jake Johnson, not the surfer singer.
Gotcha.
So Jake Johnson and Oscar Isaac could be the same person in this movie.
Oh, really?
Because he is the same, like, sort of kind of curmudgeonly, kind of a little goofy kind of a guy. And with Llewyn Davis's sort of just overall look in this film, he looks like how Jake Johnson looks when I see him in New Girl. And he just kind of pulls the same sort of faces. And it's only when he's kind of doing a little of the goofier things, like when he's getting punched and then he's yelling at the guy or whatever. That's the sort of stuff that really reminded me of the sitcom New Girl, which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing or what exactly, but I kept noticing it and was like, wow, that's so weird. Like it looks like one of them is doing an impersonation of the other. Is what it looks like to me at times.
Oh man.
So that's kind of
There's
weird.
Just so much in this film, particularly with Oscar Isaac, that I can't, I'm just so, like, this is the movie I think I became a huge Oscar Isaac fan. Like, I knew of him and I've seen him in Drive and I've seen him in all his other stuff, but he, in this one, like, he really gets to carry that movie, but also he's acting as he's playing the songs in a certain type of way. And each song has some weight to it. Each scene that he's in and as a performer and stuff like that, he can be this really talented, soulful person. But at the same time, the next minute, he is just a schmuck. He's just a schlub. You know, he's sleeping from couch to couch and taking advantage of people's free food and all that stuff. Just kind of being rather rude. And it's just, I think it's kind of a weird mix for a loser character of one of the Coen brothers. Normally, Coen brothers characters, when they're losers, like the dude, or, I don't know, maybe, I'm trying to think of other, like, loser characters. They're losers. There's, like, nothing good that they can do. Like, they don't have any.
Oh, like good, in good Raising qualities. Arizona.
Yeah.
H.I.
It's just one of those things where they don't have any redeemable qualities about them. They're not, they don't see them being good at what they're doing.
Yeah.
And when you put a guitar in his hand, oh, can you play a Gibson? Yeah, sure. And then he just starts playing Please Mr. Kennedy and he's very proficient. It's, you're seeing this talent before you and that makes those, it makes that trying to get a shot at the big time or just trying to get a shot in general. All that more tragic and all that more like gut punchy and well shit, like now he's going back to New York and to his home and I guess he's gonna give up, he's gonna go out to
The Merchant Marines, right?
The Merchant Marines, yeah, and before he does he visits his father and that's an interesting scene too, because you can't tell for a while there whether or not he is really with it or not.
Uh-huh.
You know, and of course he's not, but it's one of those things where it's like, all right, well, they've mentioned, you know, hey, aren't you Hugh Davis's kid? Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. Like he's not even really known as you're the musician, you know?
Right.
No,
right.
No, it's
right,
not
right.
That at all. It's, oh, you know, so yeah, it's, I think he's the best thing about this film.
Oh, I think so too. It's so hard for me to believe that this is just not him as a guy. You know,
yeah.
Like, he's so much this person to me when I hear him singing, and I'm like, holy shit. You know, I'm like, whoa. He's like, you know, that it was very, I was very much impressed. And so to know the other things that he's done, and I'm like, well, he's, you know, in quotes, just an actor. He's not Llewyn Davis. And I'm like, wow, that's transformative for me. It was very good. What do you think about the decision to not go to, I think it was Akron, to not go to Ohio, even though it goes
right by it? That specifically, that comes at a very specific time.
Again, just like the performance where it's a push in and the music's swelling and you think, okay, here's his moment where he's going to turn things around.
It's kind of scary too.
Yeah.
The way that the road looks,
the road is so dark.
It's so scary. Like anything can come out. The cat.
Yes.
Once he passes Akron, doesn't he seemingly hit the cat?
Yes, because he goes and checks the front. I didn't think that he had hit it, but apparently either he did or something. But, so he just, you know, he's rejected in Chicago, and in a typical film, it would be either he's accepted in Chicago and he makes it big and that's the end, or he doesn't make it there. He goes to Akron, he gets back with the woman that he was with, and they either raises this kid together or he tries to or something. But he just kind of looks at it and then just goes anyway.
So this is where I have to bring in a theory.
Uh-oh, here we go.
And it's not really a theory. I don't know. I tell me there's something here. Maybe we can figure this out together because I'm like, it's kind of half-baked. But
I think our other theories are in that same ballpark, so I think you're fine.
Yeah, well, it's about 15.4% alcohol going through here. So
telling you, you're getting
there
smarter.
Might be some. It might be hard. Yeah, am I getting smarter and smarter as we go on? At least it's sounding good.
That's right.
Watching it this time, there was something I noticed where he lets the cat out of the. There's a whole arc with the cat. It's like the only thing resembling a plot in the film.
Right.
Is the cat.
Yeah, the one through line is this cat.
Yes.
The cat.
And I think that's important.
Cat. Yeah.
Because I think the cat represents Oscar Isaac. In fact, I think the Coen brothers are trying to tell us something when he tries to call on the phone to, you know, wherever the gentleman is teaching.
He's in college teaching somewhere.
Just say Llewyn Davis has the cat. And then she goes, oh, Llewyn Davis is the cat? And he goes, no, Llewyn Davis has the cat. And she goes, so I think it's a little joke there that just they're saying Llewyn Davis is the cat. Like they're making a little bit of a joke or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But also just saying that like it's a representation of his soul, of his humanity, his whatever, you know, that his mojo, you know, that gets him to do right. And when he just finds any old cat and grabs it, and runs it back up to them, and it's not the right one, why it just might possibly mean that, you know, it's a reflection of what's happening to Llewyn Davis at the time. When when Johnny Five gets arrested and mm-hmm. put into the squad car and driven away, Llewyn Davis makes a decision right there to get up out of the car and leave Roland Turner behind, and as he's closing the door, they make a point. They make a point, Eric, to show the cat.
Mm.
And they zoom in on him a couple times, and they zoom in on Llewyn Davis, and they have this point at which, like, the cat looks like it wants to come out of the, you know, he's like, can I walk out of the door? Can I, you know, and he shuts the door and begins walking, and he hitchhikes his way the rest of the way, to his audition.
Yeah,
and
to
I
Chicago.
Feel like at that point, he's leaving behind that humanity. He's leaving behind that human connection. And that's why he doesn't get the part. And on his way back, instead of going to Akron, he's right there. He could have taken the moment to do it. And he doesn't. To see his like 2-year-old son, probably his son, 2 years old. He doesn't take it, and immediately after, almost kills a cat, or probably does kill a cat.
I like that.
So there, it's not necessarily like a fully like perfectly sewn on like thing. It's a little ambiguous. It's possibly, I'm possibly smoking too much crack. You know, I don't know. But I think there's enough there that watching it this time, totally did not catch it the first time. It came out of the theater going, okay, like, what did I just watch? With each passing, just like any of the other films we've seen over and over again, like we've watched, you know, all these, Kubrick films. We've watched a couple of Coen Brothers films, I think. And now, you know, this is one I've seen a few times. I get something out of these every time, and these patterns I keep seeing, and the things that they like to do, the Coens like to do repetitiously and stuff. I just love it. I just love that they can do that, and it leaves that open so I can make that kind of connection and go, huh, that's interesting. Like, I wonder if there's something there in terms of what this cat represents, what this feeling represents, you know?
Yeah, I really like that. I think that you could also say that, you know, the cat
they bring him home.
Yes, being mistaken, you know, not being the actual one, and him taking it almost to Chicago, which is where he goes, which is where it's not his home, right? And then eventually the cat just comes home on its own, just like how Llewyn Davis comes home on his own. And
yeah, he goes to the Gorfines, and yeah. They welcome him in. Oh, I'm so sorry about the other night. He's like, you're sorry. You know, he starts being a little bit more, you know, human. And the moment he makes that decision, the moment he says, no, I'm sorry. And they're like, and look, we forgot our cat back here. This is, see, here's Ulysses. And he's like, Ulysses? Like, holy cow. Like, you know, that's his name? Like, he's excited. He like, it's like a part of him is back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he lost when he lost Mike.
That's
there's
crazy.
Also something there too I keep thinking of in terms of how the music's written, and maybe this is much further stretch, and if this is true, who care? I mean, who really cares? But I have a feeling, I had this feeling like maybe Llewyn Davis and Mike were lovers. There might
could have been. Yeah, I mean, it definitely could have been.
And like him losing that was losing a part of him. Maybe, I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe, but. There was a slight pattern there that I was seeing that I was like, maybe this is something because he just doesn't want to hear it. And then, like, the last scene after he gets Ulysses back and he finds his way home just like Ulysses does, like, he goes and performs the Gaslight. He performs fairly well in front of everyone all by himself. And of course it's a real, it's like painful, strong, but it's still a strong performance and he feels like energized in some way that, you know, things are going to be okay. He just has to be him. And yeah. And then he's called out to be beaten by a shadowy man.
That's right. So. Where do you think Llewyn goes from here? Cause the film ends after he gets beat up a little bit. Gosh. And then he's just kind of looking out from the alley into the streets of New York.
I want to say he goes right back inside after getting beaten up. Collects his part of the pot and goes home, or the basket.
Yeah, the basket.
And goes home and maybe makes a little bit of a statement like, hey, not bad, kid, to Bob Dylan or something like that. And just continues to do this. I mean, I can't even imagine someone like Llewyn Davis on a boat as like a cabin boy or something. I can't imagine him doing that work and really letting anyone else tell him what to do. That's just not, does that really seem like something an artist like Llewyn Davis would do? Letting someone else dictate what, he doesn't even like being told what to sing. Like, I can't see him on that boat by the end of the week. Maybe he starts to be a little bit nicer to Jean, which, you know, maybe he takes her that Saturday or something like that to get the thing done. Maybe they decide to keep it. Who knows? I don't know. I would start to think this is the beginning of a rebuilding. They don't feel like they don't show enough here, which you know, you could argue that's not a good ending. Maybe it is. I don't know. I feel like it's just enough for me to go, okay, there's a little bit of hope for this guy.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to imagine that, yeah, I'm a little bit more hopeful on the side of that he maybe repairs himself and begins to repair the people around him, or himself and the relationships with people around him.
I would love for that to be the case. I think that the great thing about the way that they end the film is, you know, he does get punched. He does get smacked around, which up until this point, you know, it's kind of been, he can run his mouth and sort of do what he wants. And
I feel like he needs it.
Yeah, exactly. And so maybe that's something that will make him be a little bit more agreeable and a little bit more, or less selfish, I guess. And, you know, maybe that'll help him see the point of view of other people a little bit more, instead of being so driven and so having such tunnel vision and that kind of thing. I tend to think that he's just going to be kind of the same guy he has been. You know, he's just going to kind of scrape along, and he's going to have some good times and bad times with people, and he'll make different friends, and then he'll piss them off. And, you know, he just seems like that kind of a guy. And I don't know. I just feel like it ended there, because otherwise we would just see more of the same. And it would just be that kind of there's not that much of an arc really for him. You know, it is a character study of a movie, but it's not like he really changes all that dramatically, at least for me, from one end of the movie to the other. Ignoring the whole framing sequence, but he just seems like a guy that he knows the sort of music that he wants to make. He has all of these opportunities to do something different, but he is stubborn and he is going to make that music. And
I think that makes sense.
I think it's a great portrayal, but I think it is interesting that we have, again, that makes me think of the Coens, to where it's, no, I'm not doing big budget action film. I'm doing the movies that I want to do.
Yeah, and they just brush mainstream.
Yeah.
So closely with, like, I think the closest they get to is the Tom Hanks movie from last year, Bridge of Spies, where they I think they had a part in writing the screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, they don't. There's not a lot of. They want to do and make the things that they want to do and make, and they don't say much about it. And I imagine in the early days, I don't know. I don't know much about Joel and Ethan Coen or what they're like or whatever. All I know is from what I've seen on my television, and when I see them go up to accept awards, they just stand there and go, thank you, and then walk off stage. They don't really want to say too much for a bunch of reasons. Maybe they don't want to get in trouble with anybody else. Maybe they don't want to say anything, you know. But they definitely just kind of want to, two people seemingly that want to keep to themselves and just keep making their stuff that they make,
mm-hmm.
their films, their teaming up with the music and having the soundtrack produced by T-Bone Burnett and all these, you know, different musical talents coming together to make this incredible piece. That should all speak for itself. That should all, like, they're just the guys taking all the falling pieces and laying them out to make this all a big crazy show.
Yeah.
That you either get or you don't, I guess. Some people just
some people
will not watch this and come away with, they'll be like, what kind of ending was that? What is going on? And there once upon a time I was there. I definitely felt that way. I just think it takes some experience and some life experience and also experience in just watching the language of film to be able to see some of these patterns and some of these really good moments and being able to know the truth coming out of this and having a different perspective.
Let me ask you this. Have you seen Hail Caesar?
I have.
And how did you like that?
I really enjoyed it. It was another one of those where I walked out and I went, gosh, like, I always come out of these films feeling so mixed. Like, not that I didn't like, oh, I kind of liked it, I kind of didn't like it. It's not as clear as that. It's one of those that I know I'm going to revisit someday, and I need to get it because I know it's on. I know it just probably just came out on Blu-ray. It's one of those that I'm gonna revisit, and I know I'm gonna like it more and more the more I watch it. That is their hate letter, love letter, black comedy about classic Hollywood, mm-hmm. old time Hollywood, and they have a lot of things to say.
And they haven't had much to say about that recently, because you do have like Barton Fink and some other projects where they like to talk about Hollywood.
I can see Barton Fink and Hail Caesar taking place in the same universe.
Okay.
I can see that how crazy these people are in Hollywood, and probably based on real life people, that these are going off of. And there's just so many good, the cast is unbelievable. And the ones you heard of, like the real famous ones in the cast, aren't even the best parts of that film. The thing that you should go see Hail Caesar for is the people you haven't heard of. There's really? So many good actors and actresses in, like, people I'm like, who is that? I can't think of his name. I wish I could. Like, I could probably look him up right here. But he plays like a cowboy type of guy in the film, where he plays like an old westerny gentleman, and he's a young actor coming up, and he is unbelievable. Like, I really, his name is Alden and Ehrenreich or something like that.
Hmm.
And I think he's poised to be playing the new Han Solo, like the young Han Solo.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I think they just casted him in May. And he, you can definitely see in this film where they would get kind of a cowboy look for him and stuff like that. But he plays that old Hollywood. He just looks ripped straight out of the 50s. And he's a young guy too. I think he's a year younger than I am.
Oh, interesting. So. All right.
Okay. Amazing.
I haven't seen it yet, so I should do that, is what you're telling me.
Yes. I definitely recommend that one. Man, it's hard for me not to recommend a Coen Brothers film. It really is, because, you know, there's ones that I walk away from and I feel completely like, ha, that was an entirely straightforward, like, good film, like Fargo, you know, Big Lebowski. But much like the rest of the stuff they've been putting out recently, sometimes you walk out of Llewyn Davis or Hail Caesar and you're like, A Serious Man is another good example. I'm wrestling with my emotions. I don't know how to feel, like, because you don't walk out of one of their pictures feeling really complete.
Yeah, that's
kind
of,
it takes a few more.
That's kind of how I felt when we watched Miller's Crossing.
Yes.
Where I was like, really good. Oh, what? And did I like that? It was kind of like that. You know, this one I had a stronger initial reaction. Like I said, I didn't love it. I will say that I am enjoying the movie more the more that we're talking about it, though. We joked before we started recording about the feeling a little insufficient talking about the film, but I think that, I thought that was a pretty good job. I think we handled it quite well. I didn't realize you're gonna have some theories for me. I had
the cat is the key to everything.
That's right. I had the one theory and was like, oh man, Ben's gonna think this is stupid. So that was good to see that you are equal to the task there. Well,
yes.
do you have anything else about Inside Llewyn Davis before we wrap this one up?
Music.
Get that soundtrack, right?
I don't know if I've said it enough times. This is my, you know, since it came out in the winter, this is a winter movie for me. Mm-hmm. So we're watching it in July, of course.
Of course.
And taking the soundtrack with me to work and everything like that today, listening to it for the past week as I'm traveling, as I traveled through the winding roads of Tennessee and the mountains and stuff like that. It's perfect for traveling south and that nice folky bluegrassy type of area of the country, but also it's perfect for a long winter drive. So, yep, I love the music.
So there you go. Okay, well, I think that pretty much wraps us up. If you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for this show, for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter. Our handle is @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79, and we also have a Facebook page and an Instagram account. Just look for Plain Label Podcast, and you'll find us there. If you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to Amazon.com and search for our wish list. It's full of movies that we want, such as this one, equipment that we need, and a whole host of other goodies in case you're in the giving mood. Just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast. So I do want to thank Mr. Benjamin Teed once again for coming on and discussing another somewhat intimidating film with me. If people wanted to hear more from you or get in contact with you, where could they do so?
I'm on Twitter. I'm at Ben Teed, BENTIEDE. That's mostly where I post everything. I don't post much nowadays. But yeah, I'm kind of, I'd say that's where I post any musings or funny pictures or mostly just pictures of a puppy anymore. You know, 'cause I'm a puppy father now. So
there you go.
So yeah.
Alrighty. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.
Hang me, oh, hang me. I'll be dead and gone. Hang me, oh, hang me. I'll be dead and gone. Wouldn't mind the hanging, but the laying in the grave so long. Poor boy, I've been all around this world. Been all around Cape Girardeau, parts of Arkansas. All around Cape Girardeau, parts of Arkansas. I got so goddamn hungry, I could hide behind a straw. Poor boy, been all around this world. Went up on a mountain, there I made my stand. Went up on a mountain, there I made my stand. A rifle on my shoulder and a dagger in my hand. Poor boy, been all around this world. The rope around my neck, hang me up so high. Put the rope around my neck, they hung me up so high. The last words I heard them say, won't be long now for you to die. Poor boy, been all around this world. Hang me, oh, hang me, and I'll be dead and gone. Wouldn't mind the hanging, but the laying in the grave so long. Poor boy, been all around this world.